We're 5 minutes past, so let's go ahead and get started. I'm Mark Eccles, chairperson of the Utah Geological Survey Board, and I'd like to call this meeting of the Utah Geological Survey Board to order. It is now 8:34 on January 9th, 2019. This meeting is being held in the conference room 3110 of the Natural Resources Building in Salt Lake City, Utah. In compliance with Utah's open meeting laws, this meeting is being recorded in its entirety. This recording is classified as a public record. The following board members are in attendance: Mark Eccles, Dave Garbrecht, Ken Fleck, Alyssa Richards, Pete Kilborn, Tom Faddis, and at this point, Rick Chestnut and Sam Quigley are absent. Tom Faddis is absent. Sorry about that. The following individuals representing the Utah Geological Survey Board and the Department of Natural Resources are in attendance: Mike Hillen, Jody Patterson, Cheryl Gustin, and Bill Keach. If present, which they aren't, we welcome all visitors. As a courtesy to everyone participating in this meeting at this time, we ask for all cell phones, pagers, and other electronic devices to be turned off or changed to silent mode. The board motions and votes must be reflected in the minutes and recorded by individual board member. Let us now proceed with the agenda. And the first thing on the agenda is welcome to the meeting to everybody that made it in this morning. We're going to start with an introduction of new staff, including new state director, new director state geologist Bill Keach.
Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning to all of you. It's even earlier here.
I hope you just stay on Utah time all the time so you don't get jet lag going back and forth.
There you go.
So, should we go around the table and then have you introduce yourself after we've told you who we are?
Sure, however you want to do it.
Let's start with Jody.
I don't know if you can see me.
There you go.
There you are.
Hey, there you
Hi.
Go.
Hi. I'm Jody Patterson. I'm your financial manager.
You're the one that makes me, keeps me honest.
Well, with money.
Or helps you.
I'm Dave Garbrecht.
Let's tell them who you represent.
I represent the mining minerals.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm writing notes on my phone here, so I'm not ignoring you. I look down, I'm looking at my phone so I can write some notes here. So you're mining, so mainly coal or minerals?
No, minerals other than coal, hard rock minerals.
Okay. Okay,
I'm Ken Fleck. I've been a coal mine geologist for about 35 years here in Utah, so I'm the coal mining representative, as it were, to the board.
Okay.
Cheryl?
I'm Cheryl Gustin. I'm secretary for Hazards, Energy, and Minerals here, and also currently the board secretary for now.
Okay.
I'm Mark Eccles. I represent oil and gas on the board, and you and I have known each other long enough. I don't need to tell you any more than that, probably.
No, maybe I'll tell Steve. No.
Yeah, that could be bad.
No, Mark's been a good friend over the years. So. Okay.
Mike Hillen, and we've met.
We have.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Good. I like.
Again, thanks again for stopping by. You know, a couple weeks ago, that was a good meeting.
Yeah, it was good.
My name's Elisa Richards, and I represent the public at large, and I come from the energy education world.
What does that mean?
And your father is?
Oh, Robert Smith, Bob Smith.
The guy from University of Utah, seismology guy.
Yeah.
Yellowstone.
Geophysics.
Yeah.
Okay, that Bob Smith. Okay.
Yeah.
I met him years ago.
Yeah.
Okay, and so you said public education. What does that mean?
I run an organization, a nonprofit called the National Energy Foundation, and we do energy education across the country in partnership with mostly primarily utilities, but a lot of other different organizations.
Okay. Cool. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Pete Kilborn. I represent scientific interests on the board. I'm a retired Forest Service geologist and geographic information systems manager. And in my retirement, I'm still contracting, continuing to do some of that work.
Who do you contract to?
METI out of El Paso.
Okay. So for the private sector then?
Right, but they do a lot of government contracting, consequently. I'm not currently getting paid.
Good luck with that.
Who's winning there? So are you like an ArcGIS guy then?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Pete lives in Price.
Oh.
As does Ken.
I have some land interest down in Carbon County.
Mm-hmm.
You know where the Standard Tipple is?
Mm-hmm.
In Standardville?
Yeah, I think so.
Spring Canyon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So right across from the Tipple there, we have about 160 acres.
Oh, nice up there.
Yeah, it is.
I ride my bike up there.
Yeah, okay. Well, good. Nice to have someone in Carbon. Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. Why don't we go ahead and have the staff people introduce themselves, too. This is Bill Keach, the new director.
Hi, Bill.
And he's in Bakersfield, so we're just getting acquainted this morning.
Okay. I'm Jen Miller. I replaced Vicki Clark as publications manager back in September when she retired. I have a degree in graphic design and visual communication and a background in data management. And I started with UGS about 2.5 years ago as a designer, and still learning the ins and outs of my new position, but so far everybody's been really great and supportive, and it's been a good experience so far.
Didn't we briefly meet when
yes,
I was there?
When you were here before.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's good to see you again.
Yeah.
And I'm Jenny Erickson. I kind of replaced Jen, so to speak, when she moved positions. So I'm a graphic designer in the editorial team, and I started back at the end of September. So I have over 10 years' experience in design, in either marketing or fundraising or other capacities to some extent. But so far I've been working on a lot of video projects and have been working pretty closely with McKinsey and Marshall on updates to the website. My focus.
Okay. And we met also when I was there.
Yes, we did.
Okay, good. I remember.
Now, that's
the good thing is you both have Jen in your name.
Yeah.
One more.
And I'm Jay Hill.
Thank you, Jay.
We met. I'm a GIS developer. And I'm just replacing Marshall today.
Yeah, he said that the train broke down.
Yeah.
Good.
All right, good enough.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
My turn?
Yeah. Please go.
Are there others?
No. That's all right.
Okay. My name is Bill Keach. I've been in the oil and gas business. I did an undergraduate in geology at BYU. Went back east to Cornell to do geophysics. And went to the oil industry for about 5.5 years. And California and then the Gulf of Mexico. From there, I joined a software company called Landmark Graphics, and we did kind of high-end interpretation of seismic data. And I spent 17 years with them. They got bought by Halliburton. So I spent 17 years working out of Denver and in Houston and traveling everywhere. But that's where Mark and I first met. He had a little 3D survey, and I had software. And I said, I need data to demo. And he says, I need data that you can help me, or can you help me with the interpretation?
Okay.
And so
he said, if you'll let me use this data set, which was from the book Cliffs, and was the first 3D shot in the state of Utah back in 2000. He said, if you'll let me use this data set, I will give you more seismic attribute analyses than you can afford to buy, which he did.
And we have leveraged that relationship for years. We've taken that data set to the University of Utah and to Brigham Young and for students to work with. And so that was a data set they kept giving over the years. And that was fun. It's fun to tell people you're looking at the very first 3D seismic in the state of Utah. It was ever shot, so we've used that a lot. Then I spent, my wife's from Utah, she wanted to go back home, and we did about 13 years ago, and I spent about 12 years with the Brigham Young University and the University of Utah. If you can imagine that, and basically adjunct roles, and so I worked for EGI for 10 years, currently still teaching courses for the Chemical Engineering Department in their Masters of Petroleum Engineering program, and teaching some courses in subsurface modeling for Brigham Young right now. But in the meantime, I took a job a year in California to as a senior oil and gas engineer. So that was a new title I'd never had as engineer. You know, they always make fun of geologists. Now I was one of them. But there we've been, you know, one of the big things I was asked to do was to bring in technology. And you would think in a state that has Silicon Valley, I mean, they got the latest and greatest technology. They're still making geologic cross-sections by printing out PDF files or displaying on a screen and grabbing a snapshot of it and pasting it into PowerPoint. And that's how they're making cross-sections. And their regulatory group with, you know, 200 employees, that's the only technology they had. So in the last year, we've been able to bring in geographics, a digital interpretation software, to kind of bring them to the 21st century. And we brought in some engineering technology. That was a big program for me. So we hit a couple milestones at the end of the year, and they're now ready to off and run. Another program I was asked to bring in was drones. And how do we get drones and how do we use them for regulatory inspections? So, kind of my background, I have homes in, I have an old family home in Joseph, Utah. How many in the room know where Joseph is?
I am.
Ooh, okay. a little town near Monroe, which is south of Richfield in the Sevier County. It's an old home that my wife's family has built 100 plus years ago, so we have a home there, and we have the home in that we're going to build, that we're just closing on in Hurricane. So I'll probably rent an apartment up in Utah County, and we'll be commuting that way. I think that's probably enough for the moment.
Okay.
Maybe two, but gives you background of who I am and where I'm coming from.
Thank you.
And welcome.
Yeah, welcome.
Yeah.
Looking forward to being there.
Yeah.
Would you like to head out now, or do you want to hang around for a little while longer?
I can, if you don't mind, I'll probably head out. Is that okay?
It is. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And I'm hoping to be up in Salt Lake middle of next week. Might be Monday, might be Tuesday, Wednesday, somewhere around there.
Okay.
Great. We'll
look forward to seeing you. Safe travels.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, Bill.
Hey. Have a good day.
You too.
Okay. Bye.
Okay, the next item on the agenda is the review of board member tenures. And has somebody prepared something about that?
I just wanted to follow up with Sam, Ken, and Alyssa if they had re-upped for the next
term. I thought I had. I got on the website and I did what I thought I was supposed to do. And I'm not sure if it went through or not. I asked Pam to check on that. And she said she would, but I hadn't heard back.
It can easily fall through the cracks. I had to really persist when I did it.
I kind of thought that maybe it didn't go through.
Did you get notified?
I did not get notified, but I asked Rick, and Rick said, oh, yeah, yours went through. But I didn't. Oh. I never received anything. But Rick told me that when we saw it as a retirement thing.
Well, I can follow up with Darren here, who kind of tracks that kind of thing. I mean, they still have to be approved by the governor's office. So I'll check.
But yeah,
I see what status.
I am interested.
The status is.
The key is to be actually on the list. You know, to make sure your name, like you checked yours, is on.
Well, I submitted all the information, and I just said, I mentioned to Rick, I said, I haven't heard anything back. And he goes, oh, yeah, I think yours went through, but that's, I haven't received anything.
It was kind of like you hit enter, or it was a while ago when I did it.
Yeah, same.
And then nothing happened after
that. Right.
There's no confirmation or anything.
Yeah. And I wasn't sure anything happened.
Yeah. I actually called the first, the director of boards and had her personally check.
Okay. Rick passed along this sheet. It indicates terms, end of terms, and for those three, this sheet, which I think maybe came from Darren, but I'm not positive, indicates 2023.
Okay, so then it must have
gone. I would assume from this that they're all good to go at this point, but I'll confirm it with Darren. And then at the May meeting, we would have like the official swearing in again. And, okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Next item of business is the review of and approval of minutes from the August 22nd, 2018 board meeting. Has everybody had a chance to go through these minutes? And does anybody have any issues or comments?
Not me?
No.
No. I move that they be that the previous meeting minutes be approved.
Okay, thank you. Is there a second? It's been moved and seconded. Moved by Pete and seconded by Ken. That the minutes from August 22nd, 2018 be approved. That was quick. So
do we need to affirm you and me as chair and vice chair?
That comes at the end.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because
on the agenda. Anybody else who wants to do it.
You're good, Pete.
So, Mike, you're up.
Yeah. With the director's report. Okay. And I think just I'm going to circle back a little bit to the new staff. There are several that will be introduced later on this morning when Energy and Minerals gives their presentation. We've got two staff that started in September, Elliot Jagnecki and Ryan Gall, so they'll be introduced. And then we've also just recently hired a replacement for our metals geologist, replacing Ken Krahulik, who retired last month. That's Stephanie Mills. She doesn't start until Monday, but she's planning on being here today. She'll be introduced. Just real quick, kind of a historical trivia note. 2019 marks the 70th anniversary of UGS, basically as it is now. And it's actually a double anniversary because 100 years ago is when our predecessor launched. So in 1919, up at the University of Utah, they established a University Geological and Resource Survey of Utah, with no funding and no staff, but over over about the next three decades, that entity changed names and shifted around among different parts of the university, and then into a short-lived state of Utah entity, and then in 1949, 70 years ago, the Utah Geological and Mineralogical Survey was established in the State School of Mines and Mineral Industries up at the U. So that was the point where we had a director, Arthur Crawford, was appointed as the first director at that point, and a budget was actually given, a biennial budget of $25,000.
So the government shutdowns didn't affect them until 49.
Yes, right. No, just a little, like I said, with historical interest.
So are we planning any celebration of this?
You know, I've talked with a couple people about this. We were thinking that probably, a 75th anniversary is maybe more appropriate for something
kind of publicly visible.
Yeah.
You know, okay. For our 50th anniversary, we did a special logo that we put on our publications, that kind of thing. We might want to do that again at that point. At this point, maybe not.
I'll check with my wife. Maybe we can have a barbecue or something this summer for the board and some of the staff.
Yeah. And Jody and I talked about, maybe there's something just internally, with the staff that we can do that's a little special mark the occasion.
Okay. Yeah.
You want to move right into the financials?
Sure.
Then Jody will take us through that.
Okay, I have financials through the November accounting period. At that point, our forecast was about $415,000 that we could carry forward into next year. If you recall, we did end last year, fiscal year 18, with about $522,000, and so we are currently estimating, dipping into that about $100,000. Typically, mid-year, after our December financials are done, which are going to be wrapped up this week, we will meet as managers next week and go through a real detailed, deep view of where we are financially. We look at not just our outside revenue and make sure our grants are on track, our billings are on track, but also our operating budgets and all of that, kind of a deep dive and making sure that we make any adjustments as necessary. So that has yet to be done. That'll be done later this month. Typically, we have to adjust our outside revenue estimates down about $100,000. That's typically what we've seen. So that could come down a little bit, but also some expenditures could come down. We do anticipate some savings with some turnover, and then as we don't materialize some of our grant billings, some of those related expenditures do offset that as well. So we'll be doing a lot of that analysis next month. But all in all, I think we may end up pretty close to where we're at, give or take, $50,000 to $100,000. Our mineral lease estimate is $1.4 million for this fiscal year. That has gone up just slightly from our previous one, a previous month. And I'm just going to read what Mike Vandenberg's kind of our internal expert on this. So it is in your notes, but. And Mark, you can expand on this, but low revenues from mineral lease royalties continue to be a concern. The main factors being less production on federal lands. And Mike reports that although the November mineral lease revenue came in about 10% higher than predicted, making it three strong months now in a row. However, there's still been significant volatility in the energy markets. Most recently with oil prices dropping again quite low.
And going up 10% in the last 7 days.
Oh, and then back up. So
they dropped 40% from October till the first of the year, and now they've come up 10%.
Yeah, and this report was through December, so thanks for that update.
So volatility.
Yeah, volatility.
Just like the stock market,
So our current forecast is now at $1.4 million, like I mentioned. It was slightly up from the $1.35 earlier in the fiscal year. As a comparison, it was close to $1.5 last year and $1.6 in fiscal year 17, but not near the $3.6 that we started 4 years ago. So that's where...
Can I interject something
there?
For a long time, since middle of 2015, I have considered that it might be better for the health of the survey not to be involved with mineral lease money and give the state back the mineral lease money in exchange for support from the legislature on a permanent basis. It would mean that we wouldn't have to carry $500,000 around on our books just to cover our rear end in case there's some crisis, because so much of our budget goes to salaries and benefits that we can't not have that taken care of. And I'd like to have Bill get on board and be here for a while, but I'd like all you all to think about whether that's something that we ought to discuss in May. It's not something that's a crisis. It doesn't have to be handled immediately, but there's just so much, there's so many reasons that I think we would be more stable. First of which is that I think we're held in fairly high regard by the legislature. And I think if we made a good case, program by program, that we would be funded. Also, if you look at Mike's analysis here, which is very good and I agree with, there are some real glaring issues coming, not including the fact that we may be heading into another 2019, maybe a pretty ugly year price-wise for political reasons. It has nothing to do with demand. I mean, in the long term, I'm not terribly worried about where oil and gas prices end up, but I have no idea where they're going to go in the meantime. Third world demand is going to heal up a lot of stuff. And for Utah, which has huge natural gas production as well as oil production, the development of liquefied natural gas export facilities on the West Coast and more on the Gulf Coast, you know, that's the sort of thing that all boats float higher. Because it's a national market, and so if a whole bunch of gas is being exported, that creates more demand for our gas, even though we might not get to the export market. Although if they ever build Jordan Cove in Oregon, we have a pipeline that goes there in Ruby, and so that would give us a chance to export LNG. Another thing is that there's a shift that Mike noted away from production on federal lands, which is the source of our mineral lease money. I've been working at CITLA since October as a consultant to Dave Ure, and they have a similar problem in that not only is a lot of the development not happening on their lands right now, but they don't own very much land in the area where all this stuff's going on, or out in the Altamont Bluebell Field in the Uinta Basin. That area was homesteaded, and so it's either fee land or Indian land. And so the big increase in oil production, and our oil production has, you know, it started to decline last spring into June, and then it's come back. And I have numbers through October, and we're back up over 80,000 barrels a day, 83,000 barrels a day in October, net for the whole state, or for the Uinta Basin, just for the two counties, I'm sorry, for Uinta County and Duchesne County, which that is the Uinta Basin. There are no wells in the Uinta Basin that aren't in one of those counties, and there are no counties that have wells that are in the Uinta Basin except for those two. And so, anyway, the point is that there are just several considerations, and I think that the responsible thing for the board to do is to, we don't have to do anything, but I think we ought to have a serious discussion about it, and it not only involves oil and gas, but it also involves coal. It actually involves 19 minerals that are subject to mineral lease money. Not all of them generate revenue in the state, but I have a list of them, and some of the others do. And so I think it would be a good thing for us to look at after Bill gets his feet on the ground here with Mike and Jody. And just kind of look at all the aspects of it, because it is a worrisome thing when we're I know Jody could sleep better at night.
Yeah, and you know, and I'm glad you spoke to that. I haven't got into a recent email Mike Hillen shared with us with his forecast for next year, and that's about $1 million. And what I have in our current budget request for fiscal year 20 was 1.564, and so that's almost $600,000 less than what I have in my budget that's going before the legislature in a couple weeks. And that's significant when close to 85% of our budget is personnel.
Yeah.
And that hurts. And those are hard decisions. You know, we've had to go through that already. You know, in addition to that, next year's budget, I estimated about $600,000 for beginning what we call a beginning balance, which would be this current forecast of $415,000. So I am kind of a little nervous. I don't want to be the pessimist in the room, but that's kind of my job. and we don't like. It's hard with this volatility, and it's hard to explain to some folks why we need to save every dollar. You know, especially employees, it's hard to explain to them why we need to preserve this, you know, this balance.
Yeah. It's a big balance to carry for a state agency from year to year.
Yeah, and that volatility can range, you know, from $300,000 to $1 million. And so I support your...
I think overall, the bright spot is that that demand for oil and gas isn't going away. And natural gas is moving from being a domestic priced commodity to being an internationally priced commodity because of the amount of LNG that's being exported now. Mm-hmm. And in 2019, at the end of 2019, our domestic export capacity will be double what it was at the end of 2018. So this stuff's And these are multi-billion dollar facilities, but they're being built right now and will come online in 2019. And natural gas prices have firmed up. Part of the reason that you're seeing a little bit of an uptick in the fall was that we had a fairly cold fall early on, and natural gas prices got up over $4 for a little while in October. And the winter hasn't been that wonderful since. From a temperature standpoint, if you're selling gas, but so they've come back down, but they haven't gone back down under $3 or in the $3.50 range, and so that is what's on federal land. I mean, there's a lot of the bulk of the gas produced in the Uinta Basin, not associated with oil production at Alamo, Bluebell, and Monument Butte, comes from Natural Butte's gas field, and we have a huge federal production interest there. So anyway,
there's not as much resistance to building natural gas ports as there is to building coal ports.
No,
I figured as much.
Okay. What is behind less activity on federal lands in general?
Most difficult place to do business. One issue right now that affects a big chunk of Uinta County and quite a bit of Duchesne County is that the Ute tribe is suing the federal government over what was called the Uncompahgre Reservation, which was officially terminated in 1893 and for which the tribe received compensation in the 20th century, nobody knows where that suit's going to go. The concern is that that there's a tremendous amount of oil and gas production there, and so if this case will go to the Supreme Court, I have no doubt. So we're years from finding out what the answer is. There was something in the news yesterday that the suit's been suspended because of the government shutdown. Until the money starts coming in to pay the lawyers again, but on top of the normal hassle of dealing with federal regulation on oil and gas permitting, that's another issue. There's also concern about the air quality issues in the Uinta Basin. Which isn't specifically affecting federal lands any more than it is any other lands, but it's an issue for the Uinta Basin. It's an issue for Utah. with respect to ozone in the wintertime. And it's a weird deal. I mean, ozone in the wintertime is December, January, February if there's snow on the ground. And if there is, then we exceed the limits. If there isn't, we don't. And overall for the year, we don't. But that's not how it's enforced. And so there are all kinds of just regulatory uncertainties that are worse, that are bigger issues on federal land than they are on state land or fee land or even Indian land.
Okay.
So, thanks.
And then our next view of the budget is a roll-up of expenditures. And a new thing I implemented this year was to separate out those expenditures that are state-funded versus grant-funded. In the past, it was just all lumped together, and it was hard to know, okay, are we on budget or over budget on our grant funds or state, and do we need to borrow from one to the help of the other? So this is a new process this year, and so far it's going all right. I'll note here, like, November is, just if you simply divide the months, we're at 42% of the fiscal year. However, payroll lags behind a little bit, so payroll's only at 38.5%. So when you look at these payroll numbers, that helps explain that. But you can see in total here, so that 38%, we're still a little bit behind. Oh, what this mouse is doing that? Sorry. we're a little bit behind schedule on our budget, which is good. Typically, you know, some of our grants are seasonal, dependent on the field season. So, but our expenditures are in line with our revenue. I have another sheet I didn't share with you this time. You've probably seen it in the past. It's our revenue tracking sheet with all of our grants and all of our billings to date, and it's in line with our expenditures. I think it was about 38%. So those are good indicators.
Is that this sheet?
No, that's not. I didn't actually. I didn't know how much information you guys like to see and what you really look at, but I did not include it this time. But you can see it in this top sheet, not in detail, but this it combines these two. Right here, our dedicated credits and our federal funds, and it just lists out by grant where we are with our billings. Federal funds are grants that are direct billed federal funds. Dedicated credits could be from counties, it could be passed through from EGI, although they may get federal funds from DOE, but they pass it through to us. It's a dedicated credit to us. So anyhow, that's where we are year to date, so that represents that percentage.
So where do we stand as far as payments are concerned? Do we have any significant bills that are outstanding that haven't been settled?
No, we're
okay.
I actually did our accounts receivable summary report 2 days ago, and we're looking great.
Okay.
Probably the best we have. That includes our bookstore as well. They have quite a few. Also, we haven't had any I haven't had any financial impact due to the shutdown. I was able to do my federal draws yesterday without a problem. So, and even if there are some entities like the BLM or Forest Service where they use a different payment system that may delay us receiving that payment, I could still book the receivable on our books, so it's not an issue.
Yeah, I'm not talking about like just normal cash flow things. I'm just asking the question about we don't have any. There's no $100,000 bill that's 6 months overdue or anything.
No,
like that.
Okay. No,
yeah.
No.
Let's
see, and then I don't know if you want to see. This is our contract proposal list. This is an indicator of which applications we've put out there, which ones have been awarded, which ones are active. The green are active ones that we're currently working on. Yellow is highlighting the new ones we have recently applied for or any other changes. So we did get a new agreement with CITLA to work on some oil and gas research for about $30,000. And then groundwater put another one out. They typically annually do one for the National Groundwater Network, Monitoring Network. And then our state map.
Does anybody, I noticed that there were two earthquake working group funding proposals
right
that have been denied. Is there a story behind that?
Do you know, Mike, you might have some more insight on that then.
Yeah, so we submitted three proposals to the National Earthquake Hazard Reduction Program. One of them is our earthquake working groups that we've been doing for like 20 years.
Right.
Up until a couple of years ago, those were not competitive grants. They were just cooperative agreements. Mm-hmm. They turned to a competitive basis just a couple of years ago. This year, I'm not sure why the funding for that was not approved. Steve Bowman would have a better insight on that. One of the other ones that didn't get approved was a combined paleoseismic study involving some trenching and some surface exposure dating on two different sites. And I think, I did look at the panel's comments on that, and I think there were some technical issues that they felt it wasn't a real strong proposal.
Can that be addressed and resubmitted, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think, the hazards folks can look at that and rework the proposal and make it stronger. The third one was...
it's up there. The middle one, the Northern
mapping?
Utah.
I think that was fault trace mapping.
Yeah.
Yep. Using the new LIDAR coverage for that area, and that was put on hold. So it was recommended for funding, but the funding was not given to it. We'll see how that one shakes out. But yeah, the working groups one, I'm not sure what the difference in thought is at this point from the USGS.
Yeah.
Side of things.
I mean, it looks to me like we're going to hold two meetings that have been partially funded by the feds before, and we're going to fund them internally.
We're going to go ahead, and hold those meetings.
Yeah.
Yep. So we won't have money available to offset people's travel expense, that kind of thing that are coming in.
Right. So do we need to be in touch with our senators and U.S. congressmen about this kind of thing and have them put some pressure on, or... What goes on there?
I
it's not a huge amount of money.
No, it's not a huge amount. And I think at this point, maybe, if Steve hasn't already, just to be following up with our contact, our USGS Earthquake Hazards Program contact in Denver, mm-hmm. Rich Briggs, Ryan Gold, so they're kind of over Intermountain West issues, and just kind of really feel out, what's going on with that. Are the priorities shifting or what? And I don't know if those conversations have been had already or not, but I can follow up with Steve on that.
Which one of those had a competition factor to it?
The working group.
So competing with whom?
I think it just comes down to competing
for funds
priorities within the USGS Earthquake Hazards Program. Yeah.
Alaska, California, Washington State.
Well, those are the obvious ones.
And us.
Yeah.
But, right, for somebody to run one
or
of
Oklahoma,
these meetings
maybe.
In Utah, nobody else is going to do it.
So those are the updates. And then those are also mentioned and later on for your approval, but that's pretty much the financial.
Right, so the financial update, a couple additional personnel changes. Let's see, in our groundwater program, one of our wetlands folks, Lindsay Smith, resigned his position to take a private sector job in Texas. So we advertised in December for a new wetlands mapper. We got over 100 applicants for that position, which Human Resources is working with Diane Maynews to whittle down a short list to do interviews. So those are coming up. Let's see. Yeah, and as you're already aware, with Pam Perry's retirement, we're currently not looking to refill that administrative assistant position. We've distributed her duties between Cheryl and Star, with Jody and Linda Bennett providing backup as needed. And that's the way that we figured we'd at least proceed temporarily. You know, once Bill is on board and kind of seeing how things are working, he may want to have us refill that administrative assistant position. So we'll evaluate that over the next couple of months. Let's see. And then I did want to mention at our annual department level award ceremony that Helmut Doling was recognized with a Distinguished Service Award. Now, Helmut basically has been with us for 65 years. As an employee, as manager of the mapping program.
Since I was two.
And I'm not a young guy.
He's been doing volunteer geologic mapping for us since he retired, close to 20 years ago? 15, 20 years ago. So, we had a field review of the Salina 30 by 60 quad last fall that's probably going to be his last UGS-sponsored mapping project. So it was nice to see him with that recognition.
Give him some flat ground to work on.
As far as issues going on with the governor's office and the legislature, status of the building block request, as you may recall, our building block request for fiscal year 2020 was for $120,000 ongoing to help us with managing our digital data, which we're starting to get buried in. And we had support from the department, we had support from the governor's office. That building block made it into the governor's budget, but at a $60,000 general fund level and $60,000 coming out of dedicated credits, which are restricted funds related to contract funding and
fees.
They'd like to see us try to up the fees associated with our core center services. We see that as a fairly big challenge. Our core center, like any other core center across the country, charges very minimal fees for the services it provides. We look at that thing as a library. You know, it's a research resource. And
we're saving data that nobody else is willing to pay to save.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, when my wife was on this board in the early 90s, they looked at getting rid of it.
Really?
Yeah. They didn't do it, but Governor asked them to take a look at it. So, Lemon.
So. Yeah. So we actually had a few people from the governor's office out to give them a little tour last fall. And I don't know, it might have
backfired.
Not worked the way we hoped. Mike Vandenberg put together, I thought it was a pretty compelling argument. Basically, what we were doing at that point was part of setting up a future building block request to expand and enhance the facility. You know, the core center is full, and we've got core in an overflow facility up in Clearfield. But this one is full. And our core workshop area is not what it could be, you know, to facilitate those kinds of things. So his angle was showing the economic benefit to the state of this. You know, we've got millions of dollars worth of investment by industry represented in the cores that we have out there. So we don't see a fee increase out there. You know, to come up with, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on top of what we already bring in, which is what, $20,000 to $30,000.
Yeah, it's only about $35,000 a year.
Yeah.
So to triple that.
Yeah. So Rick and Jody and I have already we've had a phone conversation with our legislative fiscal analyst to see, okay, what are our options here in terms of kind of arguing for we need the general funds, you know, the full $120,000 really to make this position work.
Can we make a counter argument? I mean, you know, the people that are using this, by and large, fall into two categories. They are either significant taxpayers in the state of Utah paying severance tax and property tax and sales tax and all kinds of other taxes for their activities here, or they're people that are scouting opportunities to become a taxpayer in the state of Utah. So it seems to me kind of short-sighted to charge them more to come and see what we have to offer. And I, you know, I think we ought to try and make that case directly with the governor if we have to. I mean, that just seems like a kind of a weird approach.
Yeah. Well, the other argument I had with the discussion with Yvonne was not understanding their approach to this is dedicated credits, like Mike said, it's made up of either fee revenue or contract revenue. Contract revenue is restricted to that scope of work and that contract. So we can't use, you know, contract revenue we're receiving from Cache County to do a study up there to help fund this position.
Right.
Fee revenue, you know, Christofferson has been really pushing us to analyze our fees and make sure that we are calculating them appropriately, that we are recovering the cost of that, and, you know, the revenue of that fee is recovering the cost to provide that service. And so that doesn't make sense either to use that fee revenue, you know, particularly our core center makes up the majority of our fees, yeah, to fund this position. So if this might mean just some educating.
Since it is in the governor's budget, we can speak to it at our presentation to the appropriations subcommittee. So it will require support from that group if there's going to be any change to that funding structure.
Yeah. So that's natural resources?
Yes.
Funding?
Natural Resources, Ag, and yeah, we're scheduled to make that presentation on the 31st. I don't know, would there be any merit in having a board member present in the in the chamber?
It's always nice to have.
I mean, let me look who's on that committee right now, and
yeah,
see if I know anybody there really well. Okay. Last time we had a meeting, you know, over the big supplemental requests, I went and talked to them, and I knew several of the people, and I don't think it hurt.
No, and Yvonne did mention that if there's a committee member, you know, that is, you know, on our side and wants to bring that up and argue for it, that would help us a bunch. So yeah, you have the current membership listed.
I don't, but it's on the web.
Yeah. Kind of, yeah.
Is Ron Winterton on it, you know?
Yes, he is. Yeah, if you don't mind having a conversation.
Yeah, I'd be happy to have that conversation.
That would be great.
Yeah.
So that's where that stands. And then, yeah, again, you know, future building block would be the Core Research Center. But since that is not currently in, you know, it was an official building block. It's not in the governor's budget, so that's not really something that we can be.
So we start on that next year.
Yeah. And other than that, there are no legislative issues that we're aware of that would be impacting UGS at this point. So
it doesn't look like your proposed fee increase is going to put a dent in that.
No. Let's see. I remember, Jody. I guess we just needed to.
Do you want to speak to that now?
Action, right? But yeah, I guess.
Yeah. So
that's just a point of information, right? So let's touch on that.
Yeah, it's required by code that any time an agency is going to change or increase or present a new fee, that it be presented at a public meeting, and this satisfies that. And this is actually combining two fees and renaming it and increasing it slightly. Currently we have a fee for the review of geologic hazards report for new school site, which is at $500 plus travel, and a separate one for preliminary screening of a proposed school site at $550 plus travel. We propose to combine those two and rename it to simply a school site review at $575 plus travel. And historically, so I basically just increased it for the increase in compensation over the years. We don't see a lot of this. There was, I can't remember how long ago, it's been maybe about 12 years ago, where the statute changed. It was by the State Office of Education, the School Construction Guidance. They changed it from being a mandatory or required to optional. So we saw a large decrease in this. The last time we actually did one was in fiscal year 14. We had one in maybe one a year, going back to 2010. So it's not a fee that we see used often. But like I said, Christofferson has been really honest to analyze our fees, making sure that they're in line with true cost. And this is one that we were able to take a look at and change and increase. So. And subsequently, this will be presented at the Sub-Appropriations Committee meeting as well on the first day. You guys don't need to take any action on it.
And I've already covered the miscellaneous items, so the only other things in the director's report are action items.
So we need to ratify the decisions that we've already made electronically with regard to the proposals that are listed here. There are four of them.
I can bring it up, yeah.
So there's the National Groundwater Monitoring Network, which was $21,000 total project and $10,549 to the GS. The Utah 2019 state map, geologic map funding. New funding of about $300,000 requested. Anticipate that we'll receive $165,000 of that. And total project costs $600,000, which will likewise be reduced to $340,000 after the award. Mid-Mesozoic at Northern Capitol Reef National Park from the BLM, $25,000, total cost $50,000. And Utah Mineral Information Development, also from the BLM, for $50,000, total project cost $55,000. We need more of those. Does anybody have any of these four that they'd like to discuss? I propose that we have a motion to approve all four of them, in go on from there.
Approve all four.
Okay, we have a motion to approve all four. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a second. The motion was from Elisa, and the second was from David. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Passed unanimously. Hope that wasn't somebody from the public wanting to comment on the fees. No, just kidding.
It was area code 717.
No. The IRS is after you.
Yeah.
There's a warrant out for my IRS. I've heard that one before.
So, we need to talk about meeting dates for the board meetings in fiscal year 19-20. The proposed schedule is Wednesday, May 8th, Wednesday, August 14th, September 13th to 15th for the field trip, which they're talking about going to Northwestern Utah, which we haven't done in a long time. And then Wednesday, January 8th, 2021. Does anybody have any issues with any of those?
I'll be out of town on August.
So will I. So would pushing it back be better for you or pushing it forward?
Either one. Pushing it forward might be a little bit better. What about you?
I can deal with either one. I just need a bigger gap. I just need a few more days around the 14th. The 14th is going to be in the midst of a trip. And what's the...
Is the 7th
the 7th would be the... Yeah, we could...
The 7th might be too soon to have closeout numbers. We typically use that meeting to share our closeout.
So can we go to the 21st?
That
can
would
you,
be...
Can you do the 21st?
Mm-hmm.
Let's do that.
Okay.
That would actually be better for me, too. We need to vote on that, or can we just agree to it?
Just agree.
So that'll get into the system somehow?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're a little early for a break, but that's where we are, so... Take a 15-minute break. Cool the room now. Yeah, I was hoping that was a floor until November.
Yeah, really.
Okay, everybody's here. Have you started the recording?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I want to welcome everybody back to the second half of our board meeting at 9:49 a.m. And we're going to start with an update on the Energy and Minerals Program from Mike Vandenberg and the Energy and Minerals staff.
Great. So we've had a lot of turnover in the past 6 months in the Energy and Minerals Group. And I'd have to say that I think my greatest accomplishment in the last 6 months has been hiring these three amazing people. So I'm going to let them introduce themselves. Start with Elliot.
I'm Elliot Jagnecki. When did I start? In September. And I came up from Houston after working 5 years at ConocoPhillips. I got my PhD at Binghamton University in upstate New York. Sedimentologist. And I guess a petroleum geologist.
Ryan.
Hey, I'm Ryan Gall. I also started in September, and I grew up in Minnesota, and then have been out west for 10 years. Did my undergrad in Colorado and my master's at the University of Utah, working on the Green River Formation here in Utah. So after grad school, I wound up working the Green River Formation from Denver in oil and gas, worked in the mining industry in Alaska for a couple years, and now I'm excited to be here.
And Stephanie.
My name is Stephanie Mills. I'm an economic geologist. I did my undergrad at University of Texas and then my PhD at Monash University in Australia. Spent several years in industry in Australia and then moved back over here with Barrick Gold, working in Nevada. So got lots of magmatic hydrothermal experience and gold, copper, all the goodies.
So Stephanie officially starts on Monday, this coming
yet.
Monday.
Well, thank you for coming today. And welcome to all of you.
Okay, thank you.
So my goal is to surround myself with really smart people.
That's a good goal.
We can live up to it.
Okay, so I wanted to mention real quick, we got lots of things we want to talk about, but DOE has come out with two new solicitations. So this is big news for us oil and gas folks. It's been a while since DOE has come out with these. This has kind of been our bread and butter over the last 20 years, I'd say, for UGS, and it's been getting more increasingly difficult to get these large grants, unfortunately. So one of them is on EOR technologies, and they specifically mention CO2. The other one's on other advanced technologies and unconventionals. So I've been working already with the CO2 group at EGI in the Chemical Engineering Department up at the U, and along with Lauren Bergenheyer, geologist at the U. And we've come up with what we think is a really good idea for the CO2 EOR proposal. And we're also...
Yeah. What is EOR?
Sorry, Enhanced Oil Recovery.
Okay,
And we also are tossing around the ideas for the advanced technologies, but our main focus right now is the EOR proposal, because there's a concept paper due in January 25. The full proposal isn't due until later in March, but we need to get the concept paper finished. The project is potentially huge. It's up to $10 million per award. You know, I don't know how much money would come to UGS, probably $500,000 or something like that. But
can you share with us what? Oh, this
yeah.
Is
okay. So the idea is, so we recently finished a big project for DOE looking at the Uteland Butte in the Uinta Basin. So the Uteland Butte is the lowest part of the Green River Formation. It's been the target for a lot of the new horizontal drilling that's taking place in the basin. However, most of that drilling right now is taking place up here. This line represents the area of overpressure. So north of this line, it's overpressured. And so those are the wells that have been really phenomenal, very economic to drill. So that's where all the focus is right now, especially with the lower prices that we're seeing. All the wells outside of that dotted line were some of the earliest wells drilled back in 2010. And companies pretty quickly realized that in order to have an economic well, they need to be in the overpressured area. It's not that the oil isn't there, the oil's there, it just doesn't want to flow. And so the wells are not as productive. So the idea is to figure out a way to make the underpressured areas economic to drill. So if we can do that, it opens up a huge ton of reserves in the basin. So that's kind of the pitch we're going with for DOE. And you can see the red circle there. Newfield has drilled a couple of these horizontals that are really close together. They're only 1,000 feet apart. So we kind of zeroed in on those wells, hoping that maybe we can inject in one of them, push oil to the next one. So that would be one of the field tests we do. There's also a technology called Huff and Puff, which I actually don't know much about. That uses one isolated well, so we could choose any one of those kind of isolated wells where you inject, try to pressurize it, and then produce out of the same well. So the idea would be, you know, a year and a half of bench scale laboratory testing. A lot of that would happen up at the U. Of course, we would be involved in the geology side and on the core side. And then do a field test. And I've already talked to Newfield just this week, and they were surprisingly excited about it. I mean, I thought they'd be on board, but they were actually really excited about this idea, especially when we said this is up to a $10 million project. So this all kind of hinged on Newfield being on board. Their wells.
Are they still Newfield?
Right now, they're still Newfield. So we're hoping to slip this in before they become in Canada. But the asset manager for Greater Monument Butte is the one that I guess is the main guy we have to convince, and he's the one that got super excited about it when I talked to him yesterday. So I don't think with the transition to Encana, I don't think he will still be the asset manager for Great Money. So that's kind of the proposal in a nutshell.
Quick comment on questions. That. I had a meeting yesterday with the head of one of these companies that's drilling those horizontal wells up in the core part of the field there, who remain nameless. But one of the things that we discussed was potential for secondary recovery in the Green River, which I took a look at years ago with the Roosevelt unit, 15 years, 20 years ago, and we never did anything about it. But, you know, you can map the units of the Green River all the way across the basin, which all the way across that map, yep, which you can't do in the Wasatch. And he said that they're actually seriously looking at it for some of their shallower wells. That's a big question, is that the Green River had been successfully water flooded, you know, at 5,000 to 6,000 foot depths, but not at 9,000 to 10,000 foot depths, and that's a challenge.
So that's another part of the
next pitch. Year.
Well, that's another part of the pitch that we did think about, is that so the test is going to be on Uteland Butte, which is an unconventional carbonate.
Right.
You know, if it works in the Uteland Butte, it could work in other carbonate units in the Green River, and then maybe even some of the
sands.
The sands of the Green River. But,
great.
So, yeah, that, everything's on the table at this point. Okay, so we'll keep our fingers crossed. The next big thing that I've been working on recently is this proposal to expand our core center. And shoot, Ryan, in my office on my light table, there's a stack of handouts. Can you go grab those? Thanks. Forgot to bring those. So as you may know, our core center is at capacity. So the big Resolute donation we got a couple of years ago, which was 6 semi-trucks worth of core, filled our building. And we've gotten actually a lot more donations since then, because I refuse to turn anybody away. I will accept everything. So we've had to kind of come up with a temporary solution. Our temporary solution is to take pallets of core and store them up in Clearfield. Forestry Fire State Lands has given us a spot in a big warehouse they have up there. I do not see this as a long-term solution. This is just a temporary solution. You know, it's, I don't want to get rid of that core. That core is very important, but we've been moving kind of lower priority core to Clearfield. So I see this big triangular parking lot, which is basically just used, thank you, to store motor pool vehicles. I see that as a great opportunity for us to take up part of that parking lot and expand our building. We have already talked with the admin, DNR, so Mike Styler, Darren Bird, Roger Lewis, and they were, they at least didn't say flat out no to the idea of taking up part of that parking lot, so that was good. And then we arranged a tour for folks from the Governor's Office of Management and Budget. And this is the handout that I gave them on this tour. And the idea was, we were tossing around the idea of doing a, requesting a building block this past year. And that process starts in August. We decided to kind of pull back on that idea for now and try to just better promote the core center this year, put this idea on people's radar, try to make people understand the importance of the core center. So that's why we invited the governor's office, financial people, to come take a tour. So that if we do request a building block, they at least know what this building looks like and what it's used for. So as part of kind of this educational outreach, I wrote an article for the survey notes. I'm sure you all got the newest survey notes, so it's essentially the same as this handout. just describing how important the Core Center is to the state of Utah and how important it is that we have the ability to keep accepting donations. We don't want to get into a situation where somebody says, oh, we'd like to make a donation. It's like, well, we're out of room, and then all the core goes in the dumpster or something like that, which happens, unfortunately, which is terrible. Then also, as part of this, our editorial department created a video kind of highlighting why the Core Center is important, so I wanted to play that video for everybody.
This is Jenny Erickson's work, our new hive.
The Utah Geological Surveys, Utah Core Research Center, is home to the region's most complete collection of geologic core and cuttings from throughout the state. The geologic specimens found here represent more than 65 years worth of efforts and approximately $5 billion worth of investment in Utah's natural resources. The Core Center's extensive geologic library is an invaluable resource for industry professionals performing analytical research and to the development of prospective mineral and energy resources here in Utah. The collection is also considered by the academic community as a fundamental destination to conduct research and learn more about Utah's geologic assets. Our geologists are dedicated to curating this essential collection and fostering its future use for Utah industry and geologic knowledge. Learn more about the Utah Geological Survey and the Utah Core Research Center's mission at geology.utah.gov.
So, definitely kudos to editorial and Jenny Erickson. I mean, they just did a phenomenal job, I think, of putting this video together. I really like it. And this went out on our social media last week, I think. And we were even tossing around the idea of having Mike show it up at the legislative session when we give our presentation to the committee. Okay. Anybody have any questions on the Core Center or the DOE proposals?
One.
Yeah.
The Amoco cores from the Great Salt Lake, I think, are in Arizona.
Okay.
Do you suppose there's any chance
repatriated? I would love to get those. Do you know who has them?
I probably do. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I used to own that property up there, and I have the major files from Amoco. Actually, when Amoco left, they gave me their files, so let me go look.
I know we have wells with cuttings from Amoco from mm-hmm. Great Salt Lake, but we don't have any core.
Yeah,
I would love to get some of that core.
The core originally went to the University of Wyoming, and it was described in detail by, I can't remember, Jim Steidman or somebody up at the University of Wyoming, and then it somehow miraculously migrated south. And
funny how that happens.
It is. I'm sure it was just two people who knew each other, and somebody said, yeah, I got one for it. But yeah, it'd be worth trying to get
back. Yeah, we'd love to have that back.
You know, it's largely volcanics and interflow sweated materials, yeah. Soils.
Oh, was there core of the basin fill in that? The overburden?
The core was taken up at Roselle Point, I believe.
Oh, okay.
So often when they had the barge.
Got it.
They had a big rig with they drilled three wells up there.
Okay.
And came from one of them. So, three holes.
Yeah.
Oh, they were wells.
The current Amoco material that we have came from Oklahoma. So Amoco donated a lot of their material to Oklahoma, and then we've gotten our hands on about half of it, and there's still half of it sitting in Oklahoma that they're willing to give us. It's just a matter of room and money to transport it here.
I'll talk to you about that. I might have a full file drawer of stuff that I could part with.
Yeah, great. Great.
So my kids don't have to figure out what to do with it.
Okay, so I'm going to have Elliot talk a little bit about our new CITLA project. So this fall, the oil and gas group in our section signed an MOU with CITLA for $30,000 to do oil and gas related work. So you all know we've done work for Tom Fatty's on the mineral side for many, many years.
At the rate of 120 a year?
It's about 110, 120 a year. And now we finally got convinced Levon, with the help of Mark, to let us start doing some work on the oil and gas side. And we hope this year is $30,000. We hope we can maybe increase that in coming years. So Elliot's going to talk about our project that we agreed to do for CITLA for this year, which will be due at the end of the fiscal year.
So the project is focused on the northern part of Paradox Basin, which is focused on the Keene Creek, which is a shale or siltstone. And according to the USGS, there's still 470 million barrels of oil that hasn't been discovered yet for the whole basin. But the northern part hasn't really been explored heavily as of yet. There's a new operator up there called Rose Petroleum, and they're working over here. And they'll be drilling a well in the first quarter or second quarter this year. So we have two places that we're kind of focused on at looking at cycles 9 and 21. These are clastic cycles in the Paradox Basin. And we have about 10 cores that were donated from Pinnacle Ash Company. And we have those in-house. So our pitch is that we're going to look at these cores. We've identified at least two right now that are good for looking at the Cane Creek, cycle 21, and also cycle 20 or 19. And basically the goals of the task are to, you know, look at the characterization of these cores and what the resource potential are in these cycles. It takes a little bit of work. You have to slab, you have to find the right cores in the areas and all that stuff. And then basically our goals are to, describe these things, evaluate the reservoir quality, compare them to the western side over here and also to the south to see what the lateral extent and heterogeneity is of these cycles, and hopefully work more closely with Rose Petroleum in the upcoming future. Boy, the slides got messed up. But basically, this is the timeline. A final report should be due by June. We've got one core completely slabbed. I'm in the process of describing it. This is an example of it right here. The two cores that we're going to slab first is CS2209 and CS21-22. All the cores that were taken from the Pinnacle Company, Pinnacle Ash, they drilled on this anticline, so they're a little screwed up, but they you can still describe them, and we can get data from them. And in terms of Rose Petroleum, so the cores were taken right here. Their acreage is here at the Gunnison Valley unit. They have a 3D seismic volume here that they shot recently. And we've been in collaboration with them. We haven't heard word back from them yet, but we're still communicating with them. It sounded really promising that we could do a joint study with them and see how things correlate across this area. And what they are really focused on is a fractured resource play concept. So they're looking at fractures and trying to either stimulate into them and get hydrocarbons from those fractures or enhance the fracture rock. And then they are going to be doing this in the first quarter or second quarter. So We look forward to seeing what those results are and what the productivity is and what the recovery factor is in terms of how it relates to this area over here, which is where CITLA lands are. So it's going to be more of a CITLA land evaluation and see what the productivity could be. Any questions?
So there's no cores. There's never been any cores in the whole northern part of this Cane Creek play. The only cores that we had, and this was also part of our last DUE study, we're down near Big Flat, where the majority of the production is taking place. And then we realized we had these cores from this potash company, and we all thought it was Upper Paradox, whereas the King Creek is Lower Paradox, but it turns out we did a little more investigation, and we have King Creek core from the northern part. And so this was pretty exciting. So we're not suggesting that there could be oil and gas potential on the Salt Creek Incline, but it will inform the geology of the acreage just to the west where Rose Petroleum has acreage.
How far west does this potential maybe go?
No, I don't know, like
5 miles?
Five, 10 miles?
Yeah.
Okay. Something like that. And they're not on an anticline over there, so it'll be different, but it is still structurally complex. But
and the reason the Big Flat area is so productive is geology specific. There are other reasons, but one of them is the specific facies in the King Creek. And so without having any core material to the north, nobody knew if those facies even existed to the north. And so that's, we'll be doing some comparisons between the Big Flat area and these new cores.
Is that drill site right next to the highway there?
Yeah. You can go back to the
big map.
Yeah, so you can see Highway 191.
Mm-hmm.
So Salt Valley Anticline is just an extension of Arches area.
Would you expect to see any evaporites?
Oh yeah.
Oh, okay. It's the potash company. Mm-hmm. That's why they took those cores was to evaluate the potash resources. Okay.
So they took the potash deposits, but they left everything else with us.
Yeah. So they drilled the whole paradox, which are cycles of salt and clastic, salt and clastic. Of course, they didn't care about the clastic zones; they cared about the salt zones. And, they donated all the cores. They pulled out the most interesting potash.
But supposedly they had good potash results.
Yeah, they left us, they donated all the salt, all the halite, and all the clastic zones to us.
Good. So, I'm hopeful that this will, when we met, we actually met for the first time in May of last spring to try and talk about getting some oil and gas input from the UGS to CITLA, because CITLA hasn't had a geologist in the oil and gas group for several years. And they've hired a recent graduate of the U,
Tyler,
who has been in regular communication with Elliot on this. And I guess it's coming today, actually.
Yeah, he's going to come this afternoon.
And so he's getting some training out of this. But when we met in October, whenever it was, we looked at four potential projects and decided that this one was the most timely because of Rose's pending activity. But there's three others that I hope we'll be able to hook up to this
next
later
few
on.
Years. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have talked several times to Rose Petroleum. They were actually here. They visited our core center back in the spring to look at some of the King Creek cores. And so I spent a lot of time with them then. And since then, we've been emailing back and forth with the idea that maybe they would chip in some funds to do a joint study. So I told them that we basically discovered these new cores. And, of course, they were pretty excited about that because they don't have any budget to take core from up there. And so I emailed them right before Christmas. Of course, they were all out for several weeks, and I re-emailed them earlier this week to see if they would contribute some funds to a joint study. That would be the idea. Cool.
And what would be the potential depths of these holes, or is that structure dependent?
Structure dependent. There, 7,000 feet.
I think so. On the anticline itself, it's like 3,000 feet.
Okay. But out to the west,
it's
quite a bit shallower than it is down at Big Flat.
Yeah.
Down by Moab.
And then the CEO of Rose just had this press conference of how they've been working jointly with Schlumberger on geocellular modeling of fracture networks and reservoir engineering and all that stuff. And the CEO was saying it was looking very promising based on this collaborative effort that they had with Schlumberger. So he seemed very excited, and I think they're excited to do something Q1, Q2.
Great.
Great. All right. Next up is Andrew.
Do you want to sit here?
Yeah, maybe we'll switch here.
So, Mike wanted me to kind of tell you guys, I'm Andrew Ruffey, by the way, if you don't know me. I'm the industrial minerals guy. But I'm going to be talking more about metals today. So, next time Stephanie will be sitting here. Mike wanted me to talk a little bit about some of the work we've been doing for BLM related to a proposal or a notice that they put out in late 2017, and it was a pretty broad and kind of open-ended notice that they put out. They wanted information on mining districts, locatable mineral resources, more public kind of interest stuff, rock hounding, things like that. So we proposed, and they wanted some sort of integration of these things. So it was kind of a strange proposal, but we proposed to put these things together in sort of an interactive map. And so what we did is we put together some industrial mineral layers with some potential information. We put together, Ken Krulik put together a mining district layer. We got some rock hounding information put up on the interactive map, and took the Utah geosites that are on BLM land and kind of integrated all those things. But really what I wanted to talk about was the work that Ken did, because it turned out to be a really good opportunity to kind of get some really good information from sort of his wealth of knowledge before he took off. Because he'd kind of been writing these one-page summaries of all the mining districts in Utah, and he'd kind of gone through about half of those, but just didn't really have time to do the rest. And this kind of gave a funded opportunity for him to kind of finish that off. And so I'm just going to kind of show you that part of the interactive map. So what you're looking at here is the mining districts in Utah. And in the interactive map, you can click on the district, and this is going to change a little bit in the next couple of weeks. So as to kind of get the final draft out. But you can click on a district, and then you get these one-page summaries. And so the summaries have information on geologic setting, what metals have been produced, the significance of the production from the district, information on the ore deposit types, and then sort of some information on the major mines in the district, and then a couple of references if people want to go and get some more information. And so kind of partway through this project, we realized this really needs to be a publication. So I think I've got this pulled up. Let's see. So he put together an open file report sort of as a final gift to us. And that includes sort of a map of all the districts, and it's color-coded based on sort of a production value. And those are based on current metal prices. So you get a map of all the districts in Utah, and then it's got some sort of introductory information kind of describing what all this means. And then all of the one-page summaries. So kind of a really great product. I think this is going to be widely used by us. It's going to be widely used by industry. It's going to be widely used by land managers, and probably quite a bit by the public. So we just kind of wanted to show you what Ken put together in his last bit here. We've got some, we're doing a little bit more work for them over the next couple years to kind of extend this, but I kind of wanted just to kind of show this last product of Ken's off. So any questions on what we've done or what we're going to keep doing?
So were those uranium mines in the Uinta Basin underground?
That's a good question. Why don't we look at the district?
Because what you're talking about, there's some headframes out in that area that I always assume were gilsonite mines. Apparently, I just learned something.
Yeah, I don't see.
Eureka Goop.
total of $22,000 isn't...
big producer.
Can't drill a water well for that. 40 tons of oil.
And you'll
hold it out and pick up trucks now.
Notice that the Unibasin district is colored yellow, so that means it's not a big producer.
So the other question related to that is there a gilsonite component?
Not for this. So this is just metals.
Oh, I thought this was industrial minerals as well.
So the interactive map is industrial minerals. What we did was we picked sort of four locatable commodities.
Yeah.
We can't do gilsonite because it's not locatable as part of this funding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we do have good GIS on that. So, but the industrial minerals we did for this project and or this phase are bentonite, dolomite, gypsum, and limestone, and we're going to do some more of that for the next phase of work.
Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah. I'll just show you one of these.
So phase one was $50,000, and then phase two is $50,000, but we're splitting it over 2 years. So 25 this year, 25 next fiscal year.
So what are you going to do with what are the enhancements then for that?
So, I mean, just to kind of give you an idea, the industrial minerals is really drew a lot from the 30x60 quad geology that we've done. So it was really a good opportunity to kind of pull some of that together in some of these industrial mineral geology layers. So we're going to do some more industrial mineral geology layers and use, actually we're going to put out some of the data that we use to produce these as sort of data sets, which I think will be really useful to industry. And then one of the things the BLM wanted us to do was take all the data from the Bureau of Mines reports they did for evaluating the wilderness study areas, and they wanted that in a database. And we've kind of I've checked with the USGS, their National Geochemical Database, to make sure we're not duplicating any information that's already been produced, and they don't have any plans to work on that data. So kind of a good opportunity to put all that data together in a usable format.
Where's the legend for the color code under the...
So let's see, if you just expand this, and on the industrial minerals, if you click on a given... polygon, it'll give you some information on the unit, and then you can click on a descriptive page that kind of explains how we determined how we selected a given polygon, or you know, determined sort of its resource potential and that kind of thing. So,
for an example, going back to the map,
sure.
The Sand Pitch Mountains, is that the red in the right there? Is that the Sand Pitch Mountains?
So that's what is that? Flagstaff Limestone?
That's Flagstaff in the Sand Pitch. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Clearly on the Wasatch Plateau, it's the top of the plateau.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There has been some amount of production of Flagstaff Limestone for high calcium purposes in those areas. And there's quite a bit of analytical data in those areas as well.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
It's been a good chance to get some. We've had to do things like these for counties and things like that, so it's been a good opportunity to kind of make a solid set of data that we can use for those sorts of purposes.
Is this map live yet?
It is not live. Hopefully, in the next couple of weeks, it'll be up and running.
Is there anything about, do you make any calls on development potential in these things just based on the high, moderate, that you just inferred?
No, we just did resource potential, no development potential.
See, I'm a little concerned just that people will see stuff and, you know, start looking for investors and, you know, selling, you know, making deals for nothing. So,
sure.
So I just wonder if there's some way people know what the reality is on some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully, you know, hopefully they'll read through the actual description of how we made those determinations, which I think will be helpful as far as reining some of that in. But that's a thought. But I think it'll be good data for people that are actually looking for
limestone. Excellent.
Yeah.
And we try not to get too involved in deciding if something is economic or not. I mean, we're here to talk about the resource itself, not whether or not somebody can raise money to produce it.
The development scenario part's another step. Yeah.
Well, for a company not familiar with Utah, I mean, this would be a great starting point. Yeah. Sure, certainly would generate a lot of interest and a lot of investment, I would think. So.
Yeah. They throw their landman or landwoman out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Start looking into it.
Sure. Yeah. Excellent.
Well, that's all we have for today.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Good to see you all. Nice to meet you all.
Andrew, you could leave that.
Yeah, well.
I'm just wondering. Yeah, just minimize it for now.
Okay.
We may want to go to some of our pages.
Sure.
Andrew, were you the voice on the video?
My voice. For hire, no.
Yeah, there you go.
That's an inside job.
Oh. So, I decided to figure out what's going on here first. It's F5, right?
To run it?
Yeah. That's a good guess. So I decided to do almost kind of a ground zero summary of the groundwater program. It's for a number of reasons. It's been really helpful to us in the last several months to kind of think about where we are and where we're headed, because we've had a lot of really big projects finish in the last several months and in the coming months. So we have a lot of kind of open territory ahead. So I hope this is fun and pretty interesting. So what I'll do is just summarize who's in the program. I'm not clear if you've met everybody or up to date on that. And then I'll talk about current, recently completed, and speculatively hopeful upcoming projects. And I won't talk about wetland projects because Diane did that in August. And I would probably make some really unforgivable mistake talking about it. But no. So yeah, she's the expert of that. And a very brief overview of our funding. So we have this is an informal and hopefully increasingly more blurred distinction between groundwater and wetland sections. So we have 8 in groundwater and 2 right now at this moment in wetlands, and you probably have mentioned that before, but Diane's going to be conducting interviews for a new wetland mapper, a Schedule B person. And they usually have interns coming in and out. So one of the great things about our program is we have this core of really experienced, really, in my opinion, really good hydrogeologists. Each of these people can take a project from cradle to grave, manage it, do everything that's necessary to collect all the data, analyze it, and publish it. It's really nice. And you know, I've been as a colleague with these people for 22 years, so it made a lot of sense to go ahead and succeed Mike. And we have 2 relatively newer people, which is really good too, to kind of start, you know, moving up through the ladder here. But Emily's been here 2 years now, and Trevor started in July. I think you met him. So, and they're both doing really well. And Miles has been here for a couple of years. Is it a couple of years now? Yeah, so it's a really pretty steady set of people that I enjoy working with quite a bit. So there's a lot to
get at, so I'm just going to hit some of the high points. But what I've done, these are projects we're working on currently this fiscal year, and I've kind of categorized them into the different types of projects we work on. We have been doing, this is hydrogeologic framework projects are actually how the program started. This is, I realized yesterday, it's been 25 years. The first hydrogeologic framework study was by Frank Ashland in the Snyderville Basin, and they hired me to do the second one in Washington County. And I think we've had one going at some level of, some stage of its progress, probably every year since. So that's all, that's funded by the Division of Water Rights, and they usually bring in local governments and interested parties for that funding. Right now we're doing the area of Bryce Canyon, and I have a slide on that coming up. For a while, Water Rights was interested in groundwater flow models as a way to help kind of understand and inform their water right decisions in various basins. They've kind of moved away from that to water budgets, which is really an accounting of the water inputs and outputs, where those occur, how much, seasonality, things like that. So a couple of our recently completed projects have water budgets in them, and I'll show you a few slides of that coming up. And so we're kind of growing into that. It's actually pretty complicated, but I think we're making really great progress on how to do a good water budget. And right now our active project is in Jua Valley. We have a lot of equipment deployed throughout the state just monitoring conditions for a wide variety of reasons at different frequencies. This is a project that I kind of started 3 years ago looking at what effects, if any, of groundwater on the large-scale cutting of pinyon juniper forests that the BLM and Division of Wildlife are conducting. And I gave a more detailed talk about that, I guess, sometime, maybe a year ago. And that's funded by the Utah's Watershed Restoration Initiative, so kind of a new partner in this, and we hope it's going to keep going. And Stefan has been the main person on the hydrogeology of the Forge projects. And that's continuing this year, as I'll say. The other funding from Water Rights that's been going for almost 25 years, probably 23, was the detailed examination of water well cuttings. And that was how Janae was brought in, maybe 6 months after I was. So now that's now Emily McDermott. So that continues, fortunately. We're doing a lot more work now, as are all the programs, on pushing our data out to the web. And that, of course, involves a lot of work behind the scenes in establishing and maintaining the databases. But mainly Paul and Ingen Brandt and Nate Payne and Diane are involved in structuring these things and getting them out front. So, and it occurred to me that maybe you haven't seen those, so if there's time, we could go to them.
On the wetlands assessments and database and all that stuff. So are you tied in with Fish and Wildlife Service on theirs, and how is that integrated?
Yes. It's going to be our own site, but I think what this one is, and this is still in progress, what she said is it's a summary of our site data.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how it will be linked to the...
But there is an arrangement so that they get your information and update?
No doubt.
Okay.
She'd be able to answer that specifically, but knowing the way things work, that would be part of the project, for sure.
The point being that Fish and Wildlife Service manages the National Wetlands Inventory.
Yeah. Yeah, all of this is tied to that. All right, and then there's the big wetlands projects that, again, we can, if you have questions about, I'll try to answer, but yeah. Okay, so Bryce Canyon, it's actually Bryce Canyon City, so here's the park. And the issue was around Bryce Canyon City. Here's Ruby's Inn, and here's kind of the headquarters. And the Park Service was concerned about the potential impacts of some proposed development on their water supply system. So we're actually looking at quite a wide area of the basin north of Bryce. Janae's managing this. She just started this summer, and they are off to a really tremendous start, just kind of getting a feel for the area and what's there and some of the basic...
What's the scale of that? Is that just John's Valley right there?
It is. So here's 3 miles.
Okay.
This has a different name. Emery Valley. It's like, this is Emery Valley. And yeah,
the bigger
John's
unit
Valley
is John's,
up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think they wanted to extend it at least to here. If not, they might have found some things a little further that they wanted to look at. Or maybe this is it. So it's not a gigantic area. But there's some interesting things going on with drying wells and variable water quality and no surface flow and things like that.
Where does Ruby's Inn get their water?
They have a well.
Okay.
All right. So that just started, and I think we proposed for 2.5 years. And it'll be sub-equal funding from the Park Service and Water Rights. So here's Juab Valley. So I've just completed the report of a hydrogeologic framework study that myself and others did in 2015 through 2017. And so now this is a continuation, and that's kind of a structure water rights likes to start with the hydrogeologic framework for two to three years. And then move on to a water budget. So that's what we're doing here. So this is I-15, here's Nephi, and this is the overall project area. They want us to focus on the water budget of the northern part of the basin. Here's Mona Reservoir. And groundwater levels have been declining throughout the valley. And here's Current Creek, which starts in the valley, feeds into Mona Reservoir, and comes out through the Long Ridge in the Goshen Valley. So there's been issues of people not receiving their downstream water, and there's this strong groundwater input to Mono Reservoir, so we're looking at all that. We're using this to kind of develop a few new things for us, new applications. As you know, we recently have bought a drone. Nate Payne in our program is a pilot, and this is one of the first applications, I think, beyond testing. They flew over the reservoir and developed a digital surface model. They tied to benchmarks and created a digital surface model of the reservoir. This is it draped over the aerial imagery. But so now they can, and we're measuring the stage in the reservoir. So now you can use that to show exactly how much water is being stored in the reservoir. So that's good for our water budget, but I imagine it would be very helpful to the people that manage the reservoir. So that's been a good new application.
I had a quick question about that. Water source, are you looking at water source areas too? I know you're looking at the valley, but are you also looking up at where water's coming in?
Yeah.
Like on, from Sand Pitch or from the Wasatch?
Yeah, so we're even sampling the isotope composition of precipitation up in the Mount Nebo area. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a recharge. We're trying to quantify the recharge all the way through the discharge path.
I'm just thinking the Forest Service ought to be aware so that
it
might be useful.
Working
them.
With them on accessing the Snowtell site and things like that. And we had to get a permit to install some sampling equipment.
Oh, okay.
So yes. We have
that. Charlie Condrat involved?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. Trevor was contacting them.
Okay.
So, but I know that name. So another important part of measuring of the water budget is the discharge by plants and evaporation, which is together is called evapotranspiration. And in the past, as I'll show for Goshen, you kind of look at the plant coverage and then take average rates of consumption that are already published and estimate from there. But there's a way to calibrate that to your specific site, and that's with this complex thing that Jody remembers from making a whole bunch of labels for each part out in Core Shed. But this is called an eddy covariance station. And actually, Stan Smith, who's left us, proposed to do these as a way to improve our water discharge estimates for valleys. And Water Rights put in $47,000 to us to buy two of these. So here's Paul setting up the first one in Juab Valley. And there's nothing going on right here, but these are irrigated crops. And they're going to set up another one near wetlands. More northerly in the valley. So this is brand new for us. Paul's done a tremendous job of a pretty complicated system. So he's getting it up and running. So it'll be a big advancement in the way we, another big advancement in our water budget calculations. And this is a contraption that Trevor was aware of where it takes water samples after they've infiltrated a certain distance down through the soil. So he's sampling the stable isotope composition of that water. So that's a closer match to what is actually going into the water table as recharge than just the buckets we have, mm-hmm. the literal trash cans mm-hmm. we have set out. It's obviously more complicated. These are holes into the sidewall there, and there are these wicking things that draw water in. But it's another kind of advancement in our overall approach to things. This is the monitoring of groundwater response to pinyon juniper cutting. There are programs throughout the state, but we now have three established sites in the Grouse Creeks, Tinley Valley, which was kind of our first in Maine one, and Janae has taken one on down at Montezuma Creek. And those are all actually, as of yesterday, I think she finished installing everything down there. So they're all installed and running, and kind of it's a chore to keep all these things running and collecting data correctly, but that's kind of the mode we're in for a while until the cutting happens. This is one in Death Creek up here, and let's see, I think that was August. Ethan and I were down there, and this is all fill that they hauled down a hill with a ATV, and we came down there and there had been a flash flood and it was all gone. So I guess we're rethinking how to do our wing walls on our flumes. But anyway, the flume survived really well. So anyway, that's the kind of thing that happens.
Before you go,
yeah,
I want to take a picture of that because I'm working with the Forest Service on their forest plan revision, and there's some information on that screen. That
would you like me to email it to?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Help. Sure. Anything.
That might be useful, but I'll just take a quick one.
You can You can just email me too. And so our main partners on this are the BLM and wildlife. Those are the main
people that are.
The funding is from Utah's Watershed Restoration Initiative.
I can say I was working on their forest plan revision prior to the shutdown.
Oh, yeah. And hopefully will be. Okay, so here's the forage site that Stefan has been working on really extensively. This is coming out in a bulletin that's somewhere in the review process. So he did a lot of detailed hydrogeology and geochemistry in the forage area, looking at the source of the water to the geothermal site, as well as the groundwater picture around it. That's about all I'll say about it. I've reviewed all this. It's, as usual, really excellent work. And this fiscal year, he's working on helping them install groundwater monitoring wells in the site, because he has a certain amount of expertise, past expertise in that. So we don't know what the groundwater program's role will be in forage past this, but we'll just have to see. Okay, so this is one that's been completed recently. This, for me, was it's a really big advancement in how we process, collect, and process data. And I thought we put out some really useful interpretations. This is Ogden Valley, the Intermontane Valley just east of Ogden. So Ogden's down here, and here's Huntsville and Pineview Reservoir. And I won't, again, I'll just sort of highlight what I thought were the key parts. This is pretty complicated, but this is a cross-section through this Ogden City well field, which is right on this, in the middle of Pineview Reservoir. And what we showed through geochemistry, I think, was that there seems to be some incursion of Pineview Reservoir water down through the confining layer into the aquifer that then gets pumped out by the wells. So there's a little bit higher nitrate and a few other chemical signatures that indicate surface water is coming in, and it's different from this aquifer, deep aquifer water, which they also characterized. And Lucy did a lot of detailed work in this area to show how the potentiometric surface moves seasonally, and so that there can be a set of conditions where the reservoir water is higher than the potentiometric surface in the aquifer, and therefore there can be induced seepage downward, and possibly through old abandoned wells that were flooded by the reservoir.
So would you go try and find those wells and plug them off?
I don't know. I think it depends if they're just the wells or if it's, you know, if it's the seal around the wells. Mm-hmm. I guess that could be done, couldn't it?
Sure.
Put a barge out. Yeah. Why not? And then they did a good water budget. This is a very different area than what we normally work in. There's a lot of water flowing through the system. So they did a basin-wide budget, and they also broke out into great detail. This is just for the valley fill aquifer, and it shows all the different components of both the recharge and discharge. So I think this is the best groundwater budget we've done so far and the most detailed. And that will be coming out. Stephanie has it, I guess, still. It's almost working its way through. Yep. It's really big. It's going to be forever. Okay, this is Goshen Valley, which was also funded by Water Rights. This was Stefan's project. So here's the southern end of Utah Lake. This shows contoured groundwater declines in wells up to 50 feet here. And they also wanted this subdivided into three sub-areas, and so he characterized groundwater pumpage as well as chemistry and pretty much everything in all those three subdivisions, and did an overall water balances for the area as a whole and all three subdivisions. This is a project. When am I supposed to stop?
Well, technically, now? You're just supposed to start right yeah. now, so you're okay.
Oh. We're ahead of
it. We're ahead.
Yeah.
Well, I got too interested in this stuff. This is a GIS. This was a project where I think we made good advancements in our GIS applications. This shows the evapotranspiration in Goshen Valley. You can see the crop circles really prominently. This is one where he took average use water use values for different coverages. And so now for GUAB, we'll have a point right there where we actually know the value, and so it'll be a better extrapolation, spatial extrapolation. And this is something else Nate did of classifying the wetland communities in the kind of swampy area south of Utah Lake. So this is one example of our kind of interdisciplinary approach to wetland and groundwater work that we're trying to develop as well.
Using NAEP? It uses NAEP?
Yes, evidently.
That's a widely available use.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. And then this is a big, I hope, up-and-coming initiative. Stefan started by looking at just the water qualities circling Great Salt Lake. He told me most of these are actually from wells. So it was really an inventory. But a significant but kind of unknown part of Great Salt Lake's water budget is groundwater inflow. I mean, the streams you can measure and see, but there are freshwater wetlands lying the whole lake, and we know there are areas of groundwater upwelling. And it's very hard to get a handle on, but we're starting to look at that in partnership with the University of Utah, EGI. It's Trevor Irons, who's a geophysicist, and just kind of proposed to start working with us a little bit. And so we're developing ideas for how we're going to address kind of this diffuse freshwater input to Great Salt Lake. And I'm just starting to understand how important this is environmentally. I mean, this is a New York Times article about the environmental impacts of loss of area of the Great Salt Lake. So we're hoping to put together a proposal this spring. And kind of running out of time, but we're looking at a variety of different future projects. You know, it just depends on funding. And one is increased monitoring near arches, in addition to the Great Salt Lake work. We hope to continue our watershed monitoring, and they've mentioned that they want us to look at the hydrologic effects of what are called beaver dam analogs, which are basically structures they put in the stream to hold up water and create little wetlands, and this should increase recharge to the stream sediment, but it also could increase use or loss from plant use and evaporation. So we may want, hopefully we'll add that into our repertoire. And we're looking more speculatively at some way to link the effects of groundwater pumpage to spring flow decrease to changes in habitat in wetlands. That might be a far reach, but we've been talking to some people in the endangered species program about that. And finally, I just summarized some aspects of our funding over the past 5 budget years. So the top 2 are state funds and external funds, or I guess UGS state funds and external funds, which consist of both state funds, funds from other state agencies and federal. And the time average, if you take the long average, it's about $646,000 for external and $606,000 a year for UGS funds. So about even, very close. It's about right. And then this looks at federal in orange versus state. And for the program as a whole, they're about even. So it's kind of like thinking about your investments. You know, do you have a nice balance of a nice distribution? It's not, when you break it down into Diane's programs and the groundwater programs, wetlands is very highly dependent on EPA money. And they do collect, they do get a certain decent amount of state money. But they're mostly federally funded, and groundwater projects are mostly state funded. And this is predominantly the Division of Water Rights. So this is just for this fiscal year, you know, and the areas fluctuate a little bit. But that's pretty representative. So that's kind of how we're paying for all of this. We're always looking for new potential sources.
Just thinking of a potential source, getting back to this forest plan revision, mm-hmm. they have to come up with a monitoring plan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you go out, you've done studies out on the forest, mm-hmm. you know, but they're detailed at the moment. But how do you do continual change detection?
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose the best way is with imagery. And do you have a way to kind of out of the box, here's how we can help you monitor change to your wetlands or other resources?
Yeah, we're really well placed to do that kind of work in both hydrology and wetlands.
Yeah, so. I think that a tie into their plan revision monitoring. Yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah.
I'll call.
Yeah, and we have, as you said, we have worked with the Forest Service.
Yeah.
Just as an initial sweeping inventory of springs.
Right, but yeah. I'm talking about that continual.
They're also doing some treatments as well, some pinyon juniper cutting.
Mm-hmm.
But we've just been working so hard getting these three established. It's a lot of time and a lot of money invested in equipment. But yeah, I think there are some close areas that could work out for that as well. Okay. Well, it's a lot. I know I grazed over some things, and it's always a question, do you do more detail on a few projects or overview? But this was really helpful to us as we start to try to grasp as much of the new applications as we can and start some new directions, hopefully. I hope the Great Salt Lake really takes off because it's going to be a really important study.
Where's Las Vegas to pick up the snake
we are still want. Doing that.
Yeah.
What happened? The latest is for the Nevada applications. The Nevada state engineer denied all of those for Spring, Delamar, Dry Lake, Cave Valley. So those are just the basins right in east central Nevada, right next to Utah. They denied the applications and then protested their own decision. So, what they said, there was a federal remand against their previous decision. I barely know what I'm saying here. And they thought that was unreasonable. So they're still going to try to work on those, but they've been slapped down every three times now. So and then Snake Valley is another matter entirely. That we're just waiting for because we're at about 10 years of data, and Paul and I have been talking, which is kind of the benchmark or rule of thumb for what you can really, when you can really start to analyze hydrologic data in some detail. So Paul and I are talking about ways to really take this on again and kind of revive, do a new round of more sophisticated analysis of that data. And I guess most of you, many of you were on a field trip where I showed the inkling, the initial plots of some of what we're looking at.
Great field trip.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, good. It was hot, as I remember. Unseasonably hot. But it was
I don't remember that part.
Oh, really? Good.
Yeah.
Good.
really good.
Yeah, I love going out there. So, but yeah, we're going to... do you want a break, or have you seen the groundwater data portal? Do you want to? Or
sure.
Do you want to take a break?
Sure.
All right, let's see if we can get there really quickly. And me driving? Who knows? Okay. This is not... I don't think this is really where I want to go.
So is this at Springs, wells?
It's water levels and chemistry data that we have collected.
Oh.
And this is Paul... let's just start there. I'll just get there in a way that I know how to do. That's really articulate. I'm tired. Okay. So we go to Geological Resources and Groundwater Monitoring Data Portal. Paul and Nate are working on this as we speak and updating all of this. Okay, so you start with your state map. Where do you want to go? Snake Valley?
Yeah.
We're just talking about Snake Valley. Okay. This has some of my favorite data anyway. You get into a certain... Okay. So much for showing off. No.
These two shows over on the right.
There we go.
Wow.
Okay. So the data points are these red dots. So here's Highway 50. And these are new... pivots that haven't quite been permitted yet. There was some hassle over why people would put in new pivots right next to existing ones. But this is, I guess, they purchased state land and they're trying to get their operation going. So we already had wells, monitor wells on this. So they made them keep those wells up. But here's what this has transducer data
and it you get to all of the basic information, and it comes up with a water level plot. Obviously, there's an errant data point there that needs to be excised. So this just shows the water level record right here, and you can see. So, yeah, you can see the trend. This is really interesting. I'm just going. Okay, see this dip? This is when they turned on their pumps over here.
Wow.
So if you want to guess about what the impacts could be locally, yeah. So then...
You may just need to move that line over to the right. That vertical line.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll see how long it takes. But yeah, so one thing is, you can see this consistent signal, the seasonal pumping signal, and then an overall downward trend. And Paul can do trend analysis on this to separate out those mathematically. So we can really get into some detail here. So that's what that looks like.
Is it telemetered data view?
It is not. We have something like 75 transducers deployed at 35 sites or something.
Somebody just drives around and downloads them periodically?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we go out three times a year. The spring flow data are on a radioed system because that could go wrong more quickly. What's that? I thought that was clay spring. Oh, never mind.
Could we see the chart on one of those that isn't near a water pivot?
Sure. Let's see here.
And we'll get the chart on that.
Let's do one of our wells. 6. 6C is as good as any. Here's where we have 4. There's 2 in the basin fill and 2 in the carbonate aquifer. Okay, but you always have to pay attention. The slope... The Y scale varies according to what the range is, right? So it's something like 0.22 feet per year. I just happen to have calculated that. But yeah.
So we're going down whether we're near a pivot or not.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and so the question is, if you look at the long term here, you've got a peak in the late 80s, right, which makes sense relative to the big climate. And this is just on the shoulder on the overall decay of that. On the other hand, at some point, so you have that decline, and then there you see a break in slope in a lot of cases in the 2000, around 2000, where the rate of decline increases versus the climate is sort of really variable, or the precipitation is really variable, but overall steady. So that's one of the things we want to look at is that a real pumping-induced increase in the rate of decline? Because that would be better if you're calculating slopes and then projecting in the future what rate you use of decline. And there's a whole wetlands one, but I have trouble finding it. Oh, where are we? Let's try that. There we go. Wild load, but Diane and Jay Hill have developed this one. This just shows the variety of wetland data they have, and it's a similar application where everything's color coded and you can click on any polygon. I'm not as familiar with this, but so it shows its basic categorization. And so they're working on an equivalent one where they have all of their detailed site data.
So that's the same standard as the National Wetlands Inventory.
Yes. This one will sync with that, yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, that's a lot.
Thanks
but,
very much.
Yeah,
thank
you know,
very much.
If you, yeah, thanks. Let's get rid of that.
Okay, the last thing we need to do is select a chair.
chair and a vice chair for 2019. My term on the board will end in March of 2021.
Same, the both of us.
Yeah, so I've got two more years. I would like to be chairman for one more year, and the reason is that I know Bill pretty well, and I think I can be helpful there, and I know people in the legislature pretty well, and think I can be helpful there as we go through some of these things, and I'm willing to do that. If somebody else would like to be chair, that's fine with me, too. But I'm happy to do it for one more year, and then I would like to transition. Because I've been chair for a while, I'd like to transition and have another year to help whoever succeeds me to have a smooth transition. And I worry right now we're going to have a double change at the top. Rick is already retired and Bill is coming in to take his place. Mike Styler, who has been key in our funding, will be retiring, he told me the other day, probably in May. So he will be here for Bill's first trip through the legislature. And as a former legislator, that's really important. And I don't think we know yet who's going to take his place. I'm pretty sure that's true, isn't it? Do you have any idea who's going to take over?
I guess I've heard sort of rumor that perhaps Kerry Gibson is
the deputy.
Yeah, sort of mentor.
Yep. There. Yeah. And I think he's a former legislator as well. So, I mean, that's an important factor in my book.
I think a former member of our appropriations subcommittee.
Yeah. So. Yep. Yeah.
So very similar background.
And was also on the selection interview committee for our director. So, anybody else want to throw their hat in, or? We have a motion.
I move that we retain Mark as the chair.
Let's do them both.
Well, I'm not going to say about myself.
Okay. All those in favor, we have a motion, a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second for Mark Eccles to continue as chair in 2019. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Do we need a motion
for the vice chair?
Yeah. So, somebody like to make a motion to have Pete continue as the vice chairman?
I move that Pete remain as vice chair for the next year.
Is there a second or discussion?
I'll second.
Okay. Is there a discussion? Been moved and seconded that Pete continue as chairman or vice chairman. And vote. Did we just vote?
No.
Let's vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. That housekeeping is out of the way.
But I did want to make a comment that it, as vice chair, when big issues come up, like with dealing with the budget and the legislature, I, you know, have count on Mark, because you know, there's a chance that I'd have to fill in, and it's really important to be up to speed on some of these things. So when we look, I think I'd be in the same boat with Mark about just one more year, so that you groom a new set that is fully in operational.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know whether we'll have significant changes in the way we're funded during this year or 2 years, but I think there's a chance. And we'll look forward to seeing what the next 12 months brings in that regard. I would like to...
We
just got that one.
Yeah. That's it.
Migraine coming on.
Yeah. Are there any other things we need to discuss today?
Seeing none, we'll adjourn this meeting at 11:10 a.m. And I thank you all for coming.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Actually, not until May. Is that correct?
Yes.
May.
May 8th.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
So are we offline now?